Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of They Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys for listening. Thanks for liking, subscribing, sharing, following, and giving those 5-star reviews on iTunes. It makes a huge difference in the number of people that listen to this and the number of people that ultimately support the National Coast Guard Museum. So huge thank you to all of you guys.
Yeah, everybody, welcome. If it's your first time, we're glad to have you. Know you're going to enjoy what you listen to today or see if you're joining us live or if you're watching us on YouTube, however you're seeing it. After you do that, go back, listen to some old episodes, watch some old episodes. Know you're going to enjoy those too. After that, follow us. Follow us on Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, Facebook. Remember to smash that like button as hard as you can, but don't break your phone. Give us comments.
You've been watching please. YouTube? Have you been watching YouTube, dude?
Again, oh, please, man. Subscribe. I'm that trying to up awesome. My game here.
We have all been inside way too long, man. And when that's coming out, are you going to point to it next? Like, hey, click down here and make sure you hit the bell.
I have an 11 and a 13-year-old. I've been watching a ton of YouTube.
I know, man. How do you think I do that?
Yeah.
It's good.
But with that being said, everybody, again, please give us some comments. Tell us what you liked. Give us those 5-star reviews, please. And reach out if you've got a story or you know somebody who has a story. There are no bad stories. They're all good and they're all worth telling. So we want to help tell them.
For sure. And again, all in support of the National Coast Guard Museum. So we're now going to give you a reason to do all that stuff. Who we've got on the line today, Mr. Todd Ebner, former AET-2. Born in Hayward, California, raised in Phoenix, Arizona. Joined the Coast Guard back in 2004 with recruit company Sierra 168. Graduated with X-ray 168. We're going to ask him about that. And then,
oh, yeah.
first unit was Aunt Coos Bay, Oregon. Then went to Astoria for the airman program. Ended up at AET A School out in East City, graduating as Class 20 TAC 06. First operational unit from there was Barbers Point, Air Station Barbers Point in Hawaii for 4 years. Then had to do his payback tour in Kodiak, Alaska for 2 years. And from there, another payback tour to San Diego for 2.5 years. Got out in 2015 after about 11 years of service, and recently graduated nursing school at Arizona State. So huge, huge congrats to him, and is involved in a ton of other, cool side hustles and projects, and is notably a photographer. So with that, Todd, welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going? Thank you for having me.
Good. Thanks. Thanks for being here. And with that introduction, what's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
The biggest story that comes to mind took place up in Kodiak, Alaska, where I think a lot of people have good stories at. You said before that I was at Barbers Point. That was 4 years of almost nothing, and then I got to go to Alaska and see all sorts of crazy stuff.
There was a lot of surfing involved. Don't lie to us.
Yeah, and those guys know how to swim, so didn't need too much rescue there.
Right.
Especially from a C-130.
And did you switch airframes, Todd, when you went from Barbers Point to Kodiak?
I did midway through Kodiak. I did 1 year on the C-130s and then 1 year on the 60s.
Okay, cool. How does one make that transition, out of curiosity?
That's why I got sent to Kodiak.
Okay.
I wasn't supposed to go Okonis to Okonis, and they said they needed navigators up there. So they said, I forgot what the guy was called, the detailer, told me, well, I'll make this deal for you. You go up to Kodiak, I need a navigator up there this year. We'll let you switch to 60s after that.
Nice. Yeah, that's a solid deal, yeah. I think, right? Yeah.
It was all right. I was tired of living on an island, and then they sent me up to Alaska and put me on another island.
You went from a tropical paradise island to an island.
Yeah.
And what does a navigator do? Just say, man, you're one of, we have a few aviators on here, but not generally the enlisted. So stoked to hear like what you guys do on a C-130.
I'm not even sure. I've been out 5 years now, so I'm not sure if they have the H models around, because the J models don't even have navigators anymore. We got replaced by Garmin.
So did quartermasters.
We would have our charts out while flying. I was trying to fly ahead of the plane, help basically work with the pilots in terms of where you're going, making sure your clearances were okay with air traffic control. During search and rescue, we were the ones plotting and tracking the courses. And then when I was in, we also had the I can't remember the name of it anymore, but the radar systems. We were the kind of like the radar operator as well.
What I have nothing. I know nothing about air navigation except like what I've seen in a Coast Guard auxiliary pilot do from his iPad. So
okay.
I mean, you've got a nautical chart for the search patterns, probably, right?
Correct.
How are you plotting the nav for the plane? Like, aeronautical? I mean, how do you plot something at 600? I don't know, however many knots you guys go. I have no idea how many knots you go, but.
I wish we could go 600 knots. I think I was descending once. I saw us hit 450, maybe.
It's still pretty fast, but, man. I'm trying to plot something at 40 knots fast. Just doesn't happen, right? Like, very, very easily.
Good point. So, I didn't think of it compared to a boat. Yeah, we had basic ground charts for plotting, but there's basically a whole highway system up in the sky. We had what were called high and low charts that would show all the connecting points and basically like roadways, and that's how we would travel. But then when we were down doing search and rescue, especially when we throw the word rescue on our tail number, we pretty much had free rein of the airspace down low. And at that point, we weren't really using charts too much other than I was watching for terrain. But we weren't doing those the roadmap kind of charts.
You had me. It's a very important job when you said you were watching for terrain. So yeah. For sure, right?
Hopefully, everybody's watching for terrain.
I would hope so. Yeah. Is everyone a lookout on an aircraft
in front of you?
Right.
Is it like a boat? Like everyone on an aircraft's a lookout?
Yeah, if you see something, say something, kind of thing. Yeah, exactly.
Cool. All right, man. Sorry, we detracted from your story. So we're up in Kodiak.
That's okay.
I'm assuming we're on the 60.
No, this is a C-130 story.
Awesome, even better. I can't wait.
Even better, yeah.
So we had actually gone from Kodiak up to Anchorage for the night. I think it was I can't remember the original mission. I think it was just a logistics trip, and so we were just flying over to Anchorage to drop off some gear, pick up some gear, kind of thing. And we got there. We were planning on spending the night. And I remember my pilot getting a phone call and saying, we might have something kind of brewing out on the west side of Alaska. Like, okay. So I don't think we had allowances to drink or anything, but it was basically like, definitely no drinking, get some good rest. We might be launching really, really early. And then we got another message saying, I think it was a phone call saying, you guys are launching middle of the night. We have a boat that's gone missing over on the western coast of Alaska. Turns out it was from one of the villages, a boat with 17 people on board, 13 of them children, but it was a native vessel. So I think they were out whale hunting, and possibly doing some training for the kids. And so they
like a canoe. Are we talking a canoe?
It wasn't a full on canoe. It had a motor, and that was part of the problem. Is that they there was three boats. One of them had run aground as the tide was going out and stuck on the sand. And they just planned, they said this happened before, but the plan was when the tide comes back in, they'll bring the boat in, and the tide came in and the boat never showed up.
So
they went back to look for him and they'd been swept out to sea. So just adrift with no engine. So at that point, basically a big giant canoe. We got up, I remember trying to go to sleep, really couldn't sleep that much because I knew I only had about 3 or 4 hours I was going to get, if that. And then we got up in the morning, started flying out. It's still dark out. On this trip in particular, I was actually a radioman. In C-130s, you start off as a basic air crewman. And then if you're an AET, you'll become a radioman. And then you become a navigator. So I was actually still as just a radioman in this story. And they put me in contact with the village safety officer. And I was kind of, that's how I knew so many details, is I was getting the story directly from him over the radios. And he gave us coordinates. We flew out there. Sure enough, of course, they weren't there. And what we found out later on is that the boat had fouled its prop when it went into the sand. So that's why when they started, when the tide came back in, they had no engine. They just completely fouled their prop. If I'm using the right terms, I don't know. You guys tell me.
Yeah, it sounds legit.
But, I like it. And so we're flying out there, and it's overcast. I don't know if you guys have been to Alaska, but you know, it's pretty dark most of the year, except this was in August. So I'm trying to remember, this is about 10 years ago. Sun was coming up, but we weren't getting direct sunlight. So it was just kind of like you could barely see anything, and we're just cruising the coastline up and down trying to find anything, but it's basically black. Working the radars and watching the charts. Didn't have too much ground or terrain to look out for. It was all at zero. It's a really marshy kind of part of the state.
Did you guys have FLIR or anything? Like any thermal imager or anything like that?
I don't think we had FLIR on. Yeah. We do use it, but on that trip, like I said, it was just a logistics trip initially.
Yeah.
We were basically just a cargo plane set up. Otherwise, we'd have to, for FLIR, load a pallet up on the plane that they can operate it from. So I had my radar. I was searching. I wasn't on the radars. I was the radioman. I was talking to people, just trying to get the info. The navigator was using the radars to try and find anything. We weren't really seeing anything, nothing that really popped out. And it was just kind of shooting up and down the coastline of Western Alaska. And then, like I said, when the sun started to come up, we could see just a little bit of light. We're flying along and we can kind of see like this bump just off in the distance. We're like, well, let's just go check it out. We can't really find too much, or we can't see too much. And we get down low. We're probably flying 200 feet. I mean, there's really no air traffic out there. So we're just kind of doing our own thing, flying low and slow. And just as we're kind of pulling up on the bump that we had seen in the distance, all of a sudden a big old bonfire goes up. And I think three of us at the same time all said, mark, 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 to get that position. And I was like, okay, that was possibly something to check out.
Right. That's something.
Yeah, to put it mildly. I mean, nothing. And then a big ball of fire goes up from the shore. Like, okay. So I think we pretty much put that plane on its wingtip, turning around, and went into a circle around it. And sure enough, we could see one guy waving his arms. And people started coming out from under that bump. It was the boat overturned as they used it for shelter for the night. And people just started pouring out. And so we circled for a while. And we carried dewatering pumps on the planes, and we pulled the pump out of its box. It's a big giant orange crate with a parachute attached to it. And we started scavenging our box lunches for food. The box lunches are what they send us up with so we can eat while we're flying.
Okay.
And we had a whole bunch of food.
We got to talk about this one. What do the air crews get in their box lunches?
Oh, it depends on where you're stationed. How good the galley is.
Let's see. Kodiak, Alaska. Yeah, I want to hear what you had in that box lunch.
Oh, again, you're saying ask something 10 years ago. Probably a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. I think I remember Ritz, those little Ritz packets that have the cheese in the crackers.
Yep.
Tuna fish packets, which were always awful when people would open those up on the flight deck.
Oh yeah.
Granola bars, maybe an apple or an orange. And a bottle of water, usually.
Score.
Yeah, it's not bad. It was so. Yeah. Todd, question for you. In the past we had a C-130 pilot on, and he said some of them actually had a microwave on board. Did you guys have a microwave? Did you have hot food?
So that would be the J model. I was on the H model.
Okay.
We had an oven.
Oh, an oven. Even better. Oh, yeah. All right. Yeah. You guys could do like family style dinners up there if you
wanted
to.
Don't lie to me. You were cooking ribs up there.
Oh, I wish. I mean, it was not a full size oven by any means. A microwave, right. Your usual average microwave probably was bigger than this oven.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I have heard stories of guys throwing chocolate chip cookies in those. I've heard of stories of guys on long deployments lighting up George Foreman grills in the back.
All right.
Crockpots. I've heard of crockpots being run.
Food's critical, man. I mean, people get cranky when they don't eat. You know, you got to
bring a crockpot on the 45 next time we go.
No, dude. Hey, you know, quick side story. Do you remember the guy that plugged in the toaster on the 38s?
No, I don't.
Yeah, we got to talk about it, man. It zapped the whole. This is, we got an AET too. He understands that stuff. Like, I have no idea what happened, but toaster plugged in to make some grilled cheese and just destroyed.
We're getting off subject. I just wanted to make fun of Air Cruz for having a microwave. But
me too. I thought he was going to say like Grey Poupon or something. Like, right. You know what?
just little packs of French mustard.
Yeah, French mustard.
French fries.
All right, man. Sorry. So we're packing the. Packing the pump kind of crate with your food.
Yeah. Just we knew they were stuck out there overnight and all the kids and stuff, so we just wanted as much food as possible. And then on top of all that food, of course, we threw a radio on top of it, started circling around, came in for our drop, opened up the back end of the plane, and pushed the pump can out to him and got a radio down to him. And sure enough, that's when the guy told me, yeah, we fouled our prop. We've been out here all night. Everybody's okay. What else?
Awesome news. Are you guys just like, I mean, like what's the, you know, I can imagine the feeling.
It's like
at
as
that
good
point.
As it can go, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, what a deal.
Like, I don't think it was as dangerous of a story as I've heard, but it was, for me, that was the biggest 17 people all in one shot.
Right.
You know, and then you add 13, they say, hey, 13 of them are children. You're like, oh my God, we got to go find this.
Yeah,
we have
for
to
sure.
find this.
Yeah,
absolutely.
We had heard recently too, I think a couple days prior, that some kids were lost overboard in a fishing accident kind of thing. And so it was like, all right, we can't screw around on this one at all. Like, we even more so, they've lost some people already.
Yeah,
right.
Man,
so,
it gives a serious sense of urgency anytime you hear kids. I mean, that's that's
not that we weren't urgent.
Right, yeah, sure. We're urgent with everyone, but kids merit a special sense of urgency.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, that extra little bit.
Yeah.
You're in Alaska, where we call them hurricanes and make a big deal here on the East Coast. They just call it Tuesday. So, you know, you've always got that to deal with, too. That weather can turn any second up there.
Yeah, like I said, it was just overcast. But, I mean, that just meant, like, the water itself was choppy and, you know, white capping a little bit. But that's, like you said, that's Tuesday.
Right.
Well, hey, we've talked before about, you know, aerial delivery of supplies down. But can you give us, you know, from your take – how does it go? How close does it land? How do you make sure it hits the mark? That, you know, that whole kind of thing. How often does it hit the mark, maybe?
It depends on what you mean by hitting the mark. I've heard of pump cans hitting boathouses and whatnot, hitting right on the boat. But usually, I'd say within 100 feet of the boat, maybe 50 feet would be a really good shot. I mean, like I said, we can slow down. I'm pulling some old info out of my head, so it could be off, but I don't think we'd slow down much below 200 knots. So the pilots did have a counting system, and they could see when it would pass underneath their vision, count, you know, underneath the dash of the plane, count a certain amount, and then they would say drop. And that usually was pretty good at getting it within the vicinity. I haven't seen anything too far off.
And is there like a trail line attached to these crates? Is that how people heave it around in, or is it just they just have to make their way to the crate to get it?
No, they just have to make their way to it. It would still have the parachute attached to it,
right?
Which could be like a makeshift trail line, but no, not like the helicopters.
Yeah. Okay. That's what we were just curious.
Yeah.
And then who's responsible for kicking it out the back?
That would be the drop master.
The drop master. Okay. And what rate are they?
Drop master. That's typically AMTs.
AMTs.
Pretty much the back of the plane would be the AMTs. And then the front of the plane would be the AETs, and then the flight mechanic who would sit between, or sorry, the flight engineer who would sit between and slightly back of the two pilots is typically an AMT, but there were some that were AETs.
Yeah.
So either rate.
And then, but so how many master, people are you?
Yeah, how many are in there?
Yeah. An average crew is 7 people. Pilot, co-pilot, flight engineer, navigator, radio, on a normal flight, it would be a loadmaster and then a BA, basic air crewman. But quite often, loadmasters were also trained as dropmasters, or the BA would be a dropmaster would fill the BA position kind of thing.
And what does a BA do? Like the basic air crew guy that has no other cool guy clothes. I mean, there's not a bilge to clean. Yeah. So what? Yeah. What does he do?
Yeah, he gets the coffee and the water. Right. Actually, no, that was usually the radio man. But so I've gotten a lot of coffee in my life. But
we all have, man. It's okay. So,
yeah. So when I was a BA, I did get to push some stuff out, you know, just on training. I got to go stand on the on the ramp. Sorry, I was trying to think what it was called. fuzzy memory. This long ago. The BA, I would stand on the ramp and help push things out, kind of make sure that lines were being fed out properly. During search and rescue, there's two windows on either side of the plane that were not on the side, but kind of at an angle down off the sides, you know, for viewing and searching. Mm-hmm. Quite often the BA would be in one of those windows, and then the load/drop master would be in the other window.
Okay.
So those are your eyes off the side of the plane.
Cool. I get it.
When you're going to push something out the back, are you guys in like some kind of harness, or is it just like, hey, push, but yes, don't push too far? Okay.
Oh, there's absolutely a
man, that would suck, wouldn't it?
Right? No. I mean, that'd be terrifying.
That had to have been learned from experience, I bet, Bill. There was somebody, mark, shove it out.
Someone's fallen out of a C-130 somewhere. With as long as
usually warnings are for a reason. I gotta believe they said the first time though, we should probably have a belt on.
Yeah, you would think so. Yeah.
But you're right. All takes
been
is
around
one
since like Vietnam, so you never know.
That's true. Then you have to write it down like Dr. Strangelove. Yeah, they have a big, thick gunner's belt that we would have to wear. And before you took off, you would make sure it was the right length so it wasn't too long. You'd walk up to the edge, tie it off, good to go.
Right.
Smart. Okay. Yeah, I like that.
No, that's good. You're not the Rock in the Fast and the Furious hanging out the back of the plane.
Yeah, sadly, no.
No, okay. Sadly. That's awesome. What's the job of an AET-2 normally? Like, what's your day job when you're not in flight status?
Yeah, actually, I feel like 80% of the job was on the ground. Only maybe 20% of the job was actually flying. We did a lot of avionics, electrical. Most branches have either ratings or MOSs, same thing. All sorts of people in aviation you'll have. I've heard in the Air Force there's hydraulics guys, landing gear guys, weapons. In the Coast Guard, we only have AMTs, AETs, and ASTs. So the ASTs, the rescue swimmers, they'll take care of all the life support systems, the oxygen, flares. The AMTs,
they have to get their hair done once a week, too.
That's true.
He's like, yep.
Yep. Do the sewing for all the parachutes, that kind of stuff. And then
even he laughs about AMTs. It. Did you see that? That's funny. Like even that's why video is good, man. So we can see that kind of stuff. Cause otherwise I would, I would just been like, yeah,
that one slipped.
That was good.
I'll say that. Cause I would have been I tried to be a rescue swimmer. So, you know, I can say that.
Nothing but respect for the job they do. But some of them do have glorious hair.
Yes, they do. They are very pretty.
When we talk smack on sewing, man, but now like we're in the million mask sew-a-thon, you know, or across the world. So yeah, I mean, right. it's a skill that's needed, especially at this time.
Yeah, actually, my mom owns a sewing quilt store, and I work in it sometimes, helping out with the family business.
Nice,
so,
man. Quality. Now's the time.
Nothing wrong with quilting.
Heck no.
Right.
Nothing wrong with sewing. So the AMTs, they handle anything mechanical, and pretty much we'd handle anything with a wire.
Yeah.
But there was even some crossover sometimes. I know we didn't have to call over AMTs to open up panels and get inside compartments and whatnot. And but we'd get their help if we needed. And so pretty much anything with a wire, we would do maintenance on. We would do repairs, any type of radar, radios, communications.
You're like the ET of the aviation world. Hence the AET. Right. Get it. Yeah, makes sense.
Aviation, electrical technician.
Yeah. What did the what kind of power supply did the oven run on?
That's the most important question. Is the oven
most important? You know, I never had one break on me, and those don't require maintenance.
Oh,
so
nice.
That's a great question.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm guessing. off the top of my head, I'm going to guess AC, like a house.
Yeah, right. Like a house. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Sorry, man. I completely got off topic, but you're,
that's okay.
So the crew and the children that you guys just, dropped everything down to, how did they finally get off the beach? Who went out there and got them?
So we had no vessels anywhere near that part of town. And Alaska's a big place. So I think, we had nothing we could get to them. So basically at that point we talked to them. I was actually able to make the call back to the village saying, hey, we found them. We're talking to them right now. Everyone's good. And that was actually, I think why this story sticks out to me so much. Cause I actually got to hear the guy's voice when, you know, telling them everything's going to be all right.
Awesome. Yeah, like your kids are okay. Like, that's a big thing.
Like we said earlier, the importance of kids, like whatever that adds to it, it just takes to that next level. And so we gave them the coordinates and stayed overhead until their boats could come back out and pick them up.
Very cool.
So they had to transit out the river out to the open ocean, get over to them. And we just kind of stayed overhead as a comms platform at that point.
Awesome. How long is a typical mission on a C1? And I realize nothing's typical. It's the Coast Guard still, but typical. Roughly, like, how long are you guys in the air most of the time when you're doing something like that?
I'd probably say average 6 hours, six to 8 hours, maybe. I've definitely had shorter. I've had as long as 13-hour flights, missions. So I know that we couldn't do it, but the J models could go from Hawaii all the way down to Guam in one shot. We usually had to stay over some night in, like, Wake Island. So that's a long flight. I think that was closer. Well, no, I think it was a shorter flight because they could actually go faster. I think. Don't hold me to that.
That's okay. I'm not. I won't remember that.
So what did you guys do in Hawaii? What was kind of the C-130's mission out there? It sounds like you're making logistics runs to the Far East. What was kind of like a normal caseload routine kind of thing?
That's what I liked about Hawaii. There was definitely even more than normal. No normal.
Yeah.
We do logistics runs all over throughout the islands. There wasn't too much long range search and rescue in the 4 years I was there. I finally got a decent case, I think just a couple of weeks before I headed up to Alaska. Just an overdue vessel that we went out and found, sailing from California to Hawaii. They just disappeared and we found them about 50 miles off the Big Island.
Oh, score. Yeah, at least you didn't have to fly like halfway between them, you know, and do something out there. Yeah.
But I've done some really bizarre stuff too. I mean, I think all the C-130s from all the air stations would go down and participate in Central America with some of the drug patrols. That famous video that I love of the guy on the submarine, the Alto Subargo guy. There was probably a C-130 overhead, I would imagine. Right. That would be from one of the air stations.
Yeah, there was something overhead for sure. I'm sure of that.
I had some bizarre ones. I've flown a dead whale over from Maui.
In the cabin?
In the back of the plane, yeah.
Yeah, what was that about?
It didn't explode.
Dude, at least. What was the... God. I've smelled a dead whale before.
Oh, well, that is. I could tell that story. It doesn't sound like an interesting story, does it?
No, not at all.
Sounds really interesting. Yeah. You put a dead whale...
Yeah, yeah. So it was called a beak whale, which I guess is not native to Hawaii, or at least in the shallow. It's a deep water, cold water whale. And it was acting bizarre in the shallows off the coast of Maui. And they brought it, I think it died in the water. They brought it out and the University of Hawaii wanted to do an autopsy and figure out what was going on. And so they called the Coast Guard and we said, we can figure it out. So they sent us over.
Dude, who made that call? You know, who made that call, right? Who was like, we'll figure it out. No big deal, right? Yeah,
Allow me to say three letters. O-E-R.
Yeah, that was not the guy that had to figure it out whatsoever.
Yeah, followed by, I'm sorry, we're going to go pick up what?
Yeah, right?
There wasn't a boat somewhere to put the whale on. That's what's crazy to me.
No. Well, they needed it stat just because it had just died and they needed data quick. So we pull up and sure enough, there's a flatbed truck with a whale on the back of it at the airport. It's like, oh, okay. So just pallet by pallet, we loaded on the back. The truck pretty much matched up to the back of our airplane, and we slid that thing on. And
is it in anything? Like, was it in crates?
No,
or something? No, it's just like the whale.
Here's your whale. Yeah.
Dude.
How big was it roughly? Like, is it, I mean, I kind of know how big the inside of a C-130 is. Was it taking up like most of that flight deck or most of the deck back there? Or
I'd say probably took up 3/4. I mean, out in Hawaii,
okay, that's a big, it's a big animal.
Yeah. There was we always have the humpback whales out there, and that's what I was kind of picturing. The beak whale is smaller, but it still was like, right. Oh my God, we've got a whale on our plane. So, there was a day in Hawaii when you could look up and point at the sky and say, there's a whale flying by.
Whales are flying. That's awesome.
Yeah. When whales fly.
Please tell me you took pictures. You have pictures of that somewhere.
I know. Oh man. I know I do somewhere. This was probably about 2006, 2007. So,
right. Cause that's the kind of thing that you're like, oh my God, I have to take a picture of this.
I found pictures of it online.
Oh really? Okay.
I have found pictures of it online. Let's see what else.
How long was the flight with this whale in the plane?
From Maui to Oahu, probably about 20 minutes. I gotta grab a cable really quick.
Yeah,
it was probably only about 20 minutes.
I'm guessing it took longer to get it on the plane and off the plane than the actual flight time, probably.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How was the smell, man?
I was just going to say, the one thing I remember was putting that air vent in my face and just blasting that thing for fresh air.
Come on, you were in an ant as a non-rate. It was probably no worse than Aton.
I never had that big of a problem with Aton, actually. That was kind of fun. Sorry, moving the camera around here. There we go.
That was our first, mine and Todd's first conversation was about like, hey, what was your first unit? And he said it was the ant out in Coos Bay. And I was like, so did you enjoy being covered in bird crap? You know, and that it just went from there. I told him that you and him would get along well, Bill.
I love Aton.
I know you do.
Looking back on it, that was actually a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, just as a non-rate, you don't have any real responsibilities. That was a good time.
Right. And as a non-rate, it's a great job because like there's some days as in the Coast Guard, you don't really know what you did that day when you don't have cases and stuff like that. And Aton, you kind of always at least can see what you did. Like, hey, those lights blink because of me.
Yeah, exactly.
Dude, that whale thing is just killing me. I cannot believe it.
Phil's stuck on a dead whale.
It blows my mind, dude. I mean, having smelled a dead whale, I would not want to be cooped up in an airplane with that thing.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, no way.
Air conditioning in the face.
No way. Oh. Talk to us
a little bit. We've done. Hey,
go ahead, Todd. Sorry.
I was going to say, we've also done dead dolphins, and those came in like a giant Ziploc bag.
See, now that makes sense to me, right? At least you put them in a giant Ziploc bag, and they weren't just deteriorating on the deck, man. Oh. For the boat that you talked about that you guys found that was transiting between California and Hawaii, how did you find that boat, if you remember, in such a vast expanse of the sea?
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor.
We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT. Want to check out is the Always Ready Collective, delivering art by and for daring fighters of the sea with their maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. Visit them on Facebook, Etsy, Instagram, and at alwaysreadycollective.com.
That one, I remember I was a navigator on because I was working the radar, and it was the radar that definitely started picking up. And we were able to kind of tell vessels that did have signals. We could discount those. And then we picked up a very obvious signal that was like, oh, okay, this is something we need to go check out. This is like a legit boat or, you know, a legit target on our radar, but it doesn't have a signal. And I mean, we were up there for probably 3-4 hours, just bouncing around from boat to boat, kind of just surfing around.
Yeah. Did they know they were in distress, or were they?
Yeah, they were overdue by about overdue for several days.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
Oops, sorry. Having some technical difficulties on my end here. Sorry.
No, no worries, man. It's just Bill does the same thing pretty much every time.
Right away. It's my fault.
I know. I'm just saying. Just kidding.
Hey, once you get your technical difficulties worked out, Todd, so you were talking about deployments down to Central America, East Pac, Western Caribbean, that kind of stuff. Any part of any cool or interesting, you know, drug busts, anything like that? Were you pretty successful down there? Or?
Not me personally. I swear I was the black sheep. Like, I was in the wrong place the wrong time. I used to say, like, if I was on duty, you knew you were getting a good night of sleep, is what it felt like.
That's my favorite kind.
I did have a good bust. Went out to Guam. The Te Hung Fa was a fishing vessel that was repeatedly fishing in our waters. I was part of the bust. We tracked that thing for a long time and just kept incident after incident of them fishing in our waters when they were, I want to say a Chinese fishing vessel. So, and they ended up getting like $1.5 million fine, boat was seized. And that was cool because that was my first case of like, we had to turn in our logs, our radio logs, all that stuff. It was like building an actual legal case against them.
Well, how did that whole thing go down?
That's about all I remember.
Yeah.
I think you just got the story.
Cool. Yeah.
Well, so when you guys go out there, I mean, you're just marking positions and then tracking until a surface asset can get there, or what's kind of the MO from the boat?
I know in Alaska, we would watch the Russian American line and they could get down and they could tell boats, within meters if they were across the US Russian line.
Yeah.
So we had our little zones we had to go check that were, protected fishing areas. And we could tell the moment they crossed in within meters if they weren't where they were supposed to be. And usually they didn't know we were there. We could stay up pretty high and read some names off those boats and get their numbers and all that good stuff.
I love fisheries, man. Fisheries is a blast.
I'll say from the surface side, having done some of the counter-drug missions, there were times I'd be talking to a C-130 and they'd be telling me stuff and I never even knew they were there. You'd never see them. You'd never notice them. You know, every once in a while you're looking up, there'd be just enough clouds here or there and never have a clue where the plane was. And you'd be like, oh yeah, there's three guys on the boat and the hull number's this. And I had to be 20 feet away before I could tell you guys were thousands. It's amazing what you guys can do.
I think we were usually up there and then well above us was an AWAC usually guiding us we were kind of doing the same, like, yeah, there's a plane up there somewhere. We don't know.
Well, that's wild.
We know it's there, but.
What
and then
go ahead. Yeah. Sorry. Nope. Go ahead.
Oh no. Go for it.
What for?
I was gonna say. Yeah, man.
You did. We did it again. I'm gonna let you go. Go for it.
Okay. The other one that was kind of interesting that I saw was because we'd fly around the South Pacific all the time. We have missions going out there. So, Kiribati, Marshall Islands, Shaw Nation, Samoa, Guam, flew over Saipan, that kind of stuff. I got to go down to Samoa for a pretty good trip and they said, we're taking a bunch of US Marshals. A bunch of federal agents, one US Marshal, and you're taking two prisoners down there. And so the day comes and we're going to be down there for about, I think 4 or 5 days. And sure enough, these two guys get out. I think they were Samoan. I'm 6'5" and they made me feel small. These guys got in with orange jumpsuits, hands in handcuffs. And I was like, oh my God, these guys are freaking huge. And they get on with the biggest smiles on their face. Like, hey, how's it going? I'm like, hey,
ever seen Con Air?
Take over the plane.
Ever seen Con Air, Todd? It's coming.
Right.
Yeah. Basically like that. And that's who the, US Marshal was escorting down there. And, we're like, so what are the FBI agents for? And they're like, not really sure, but you're taking them. That's all we know. Like, cool.
Okay.
So you fly down there and, you know, cracking jokes the whole time about hope these two convicts that are bigger than every one of us don't take over the plane kind of thing. And make sure you barricade the Todd, you're in radios. Make sure you barricade the flight deck. You're the one right there.
Like, you're okay, the great, first cool. to go down. Yeah.
Right.
I'll jump right on that, literally. Right. So we get down there and we're just kind of, we're told, hey, okay, we're not taking off for 3 days. So I remember we went to, Tisa's Barefoot Bar, which is this awesome little barefoot bar out there. We had steaks and shrimp and all that. And so we just kind of spent a couple days touring the island. And then on the way back, or the night before, we're supposed to come back I think we had like a late takeoff. So we were able to go to the bar and just like have a drink the night before. And I remember some of the FBI guys bought us a drink for flying them down there. And they eventually were like, all right, well, we got to take off. We got an early morning. Like, okay, cool. No problem. And the next day, I'm out there doing my pre-flights on the plane, checking all my stuff. And a whole bunch of SUVs pull up and saw the FBI guys get out that we are taken. So they've all got armored vests on. They got their ARs or whatever they were carrying, but they've got rifles. And like, oh, what's going on? And I'm talking to whoever else is on the flight deck with me. We have no idea what's going on. So I start looking around. They're all scattered around. Basically, some of them, if they need to take cover behind their cars, that kind of thing. I'm like, oh, we didn't know about any of this. I start looking around the flight deck to look for the biggest piece of avionics to jump behind if I need to, if lead starts flying. And a couple more SUVs pull up, and a guy gets out, and it turns out it's the lieutenant governor of Samoa. He was being brought up on some white-collar charges. I can't remember exactly what, but it turns out they were there the whole time doing an investigation, trying to get the lieutenant governor of Samoa to turn himself in. And he did, calmly. No resistance, thank God. But, so we put him in handcuffs and got him on the plane and flew him back to Honolulu.
That's like, awesome, man. What a story. Cool, yeah, that's cool. Yeah.
I had no idea that was what we were down here for. I had a good time touring Samoa.
Right. I didn't even know this was even the thing. That's awesome, man. What a great story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dude, that's like crazy. You said, no day's normal, right? Like a no U.S. Normal. Coast Guard, man, no day is normal. That's awesome. Well, tell us about, so, you know, people are gonna listen to this episode, Todd, and they're gonna hear the unreal adventures of the AT2. What if they want to go that route, what's the school like?
The school is 4 to 5 months long when I went through it. It's 4 sections, and basically you start off learning all of your electrical theory. So the whole time you're doing a lot of math in the beginning, learning the basics of AC, DC, all that type of stuff. And then you start going more into, now you're asking me to remember stuff from 15 years ago.
You can tell us anything, we'll believe you.
Yeah, there is that. Move my hand. Go through a lot of basic radios. I think we asked all the time, like, is this aircraft specific? No, we were just learning basic systems of the aircraft, how the navigational tools work, how the radios work, all that kind of stuff. And then in the final one, they just teach us how to solder and what was the other thing? Safety wire, really basic kind of stuff. So it was a good time. It was kind of a, I don't know, you had to make fun out of what you were doing. You know what doesn't exist anymore? I just found out not too long ago was the donut. That's the old barracks. It was an awful, awful place. They tore it down. They put up some new stuff. So that'll be a nice, that's almost like a rite of passage that I think any newer AETs didn't have to go through.
What was your biggest complaint? What was your biggest complaint with the donut?
Probably fear for my health.
Just the I've asbestos coming through the wall.
Yeah, the asbestos or the brown recluses or I know when I was there that we weren't allowed to have surge protectors, you know, plug in multiple things because someone would turn on a microwave and it would kill power to the whole building.
Nice. Where we train the AETs.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah, they were go troubleshoot it yourself.
Yeah.
And I was there in 2006, and I can remember having to get this awful dial-up connection that, you know, everybody's on dial-up in this one building that was not built for, I think, even telephone lines, it felt like. And that was brutal because it just felt like you're in the Stone Age.
Yeah.
Right.
Nothing's changed. Even with the new barracks, man, it's still like, you know, people are still dirty. Internet still sucks. It's just, you just got to deal with it.
Yeah.
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 What was it harder? Was it a challenge?
It's a younger mold.
Oh, what's that?
Was the school a challenge?
Oh yeah, it was definitely a challenge. Yeah. We had tests all the time. I feel like they were pretty high pressure. I mean, it was basically if you fail, you're out, if I remember correctly. but it just forced me to get my nose in the books. I can remember us having study sessions, laying out wiring diagrams in our floor, and you just have wiring diagrams everywhere, trying to teach each other stuff and trying to expect what they were going to throw at us as curveballs on the tests. I mean, I think tests were they daily? I don't know. I feel like we had daily quizzes that were important, and then big tests over electrical theory and how to troubleshoot. And I am not a troubleshooter. I was definitely a flyer. So I'm pretty sure we're the only branch, the fixers and the flyers are the same people.
Right.
And I joined a fly. I was not a very good maintenance guy. I was not good at troubleshooting. I usually be sitting there just with my colored pencils trying to draw the lines on the wiring diagrams. And someone else would just look at it and go, okay, I know where the problem is. Let's go. Like, okay, thank God.
Yeah.
I'm glad you looked at it.
I'm glad you're here. Yeah, good.
You want me to take your flight? I'll take your flight.
Right.
And what? How did they pick the airframes out of school?
Just by location.
Location.
I knew I wanted to go to Hawaii, so I fought like hell to go there, thinking I'd get on the helicopters because I joined to be a rescue swimmer, failed out of that, thought, okay, I'll be a flight mechanic. Hey, Hawaii would be a cool place to go be a flight mechanic at. And got there, and they're like, cool, you're going C-130s. So my master's chief decided what I was doing.
Yeah. And then you got the deal to make to switch to 60s to get back to helicopters. What was the transition like from C-130s to 60s? Was it a nightmare trying to cross train and stuff, or is it just plug and play?
It helped that I was a second class, had some experience troubleshooting. I wasn't fresh out of A school, but yeah, going through my BA syllabus on that. It was interesting. I only had a year in Kodiak on the 60s, so they kind of didn't want to deal with me too much. So I just got BA qualified, and then I was basically just ground crew from there out. So I didn't really have the best experience up there with that. When I got down to San Diego, it was nice to be down there. I got to fly a little bit more, get a little bit more training. The BA syllabus, though, on the 60, yeah, actually, it did help quite a bit that I was pretty versed on the C-130 already. I knew all the like the flares and all the equipment that we would carry. It translated well.
Yeah. Sorry, Bill, I cut you off a minute ago.
No, I was going to ask Todd. So I know you said AST was your original goal.
It was.
You weren't successful at that, which a lot of people aren't successful at that. But so did you go to ASTA school? Or
I did not even make it to the A school. I got told during the airman program.
Right.
So like I said earlier, I'm 6'5". I was 230 at the time, and I had the wingspan of somebody that's 7'1". Okay. So I'm kind of built like a long.
You built like Michael
Phelps. Long-armed gorilla. Basically, yeah. So you were also asking me earlier about boot camp. I was in boot camp for an extra 2 weeks because of push-ups.
Right.
I finally got good at push-ups, and then I got into the AST program, and I was bad at pull-ups. So I grew up as a competitive swimmer.
Yep.
Too much arm distance.
Yeah.
You do the physics, it's not in my favor.
Yeah. We're built similarly, Todd. I have the same problem.
Ah, okay. Yeah, most rescue swimmers aren't tall or heavy.
They're amazingly like small. Usually when you look at them, you think that, and they're all, I mean, again, the job they do is amazing. And some of the stories we've heard from them, I couldn't do what they do. I know that, but they're not big people, but they're not at all big people.
Until they make E7, and then they balloon up like crazy, but they still run air crew. Right? We all know that. I've seen that. We've all seen it. I love it. I'm always man, I love it how you guys still make it happen, you know, plus
Phil
60.
Said that I didn't.
I did. Right. It's fine. I'll take the hit. That's funny. Hey, Todd, could you do one pull up?
At the time, no. Now I can, yes.
Perfect. That's it, man. That's all. You got to be able to do one. You know what I mean? When somebody says like, "Hey, we're going to do pull ups," as long as you can do one, at least you can do one. Isn't it? I know the feeling, man. Like when you first start doing pull ups, if you've never done them before, because it used to not be a thing. I don't think until like CrossFit came into being in the Coast Guard, but it was like.
Yeah.
You know, when it came time to do pull-ups at the Miss team, we had like 100 guys lined up, right? And it would be, I don't know, 20% couldn't do a pull-up. And, man, that's something I think everyone needs to work on doing at least one. You got to do one.
Yeah. I was going to say, you said 20%,
yeah.
20% couldn't do one, and probably of the other 80% 70% of them could only do one probably.
Yeah, but then there's another 10% that can do like Spider-Man pull-ups, you know, like pull right. up to the bar and then go over top. Yeah. I still haven't figured out the physics of that one. Yeah,
Those are the dudes that are like 5'2". They're the same guys who bust out like 100 push-ups in a minute during a PT test. It, like Todd said, physics is part of it.
Right, physics is definitely part of it. Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, I think at the time I could break the record for the swim in Astoria. I could do a 551, 500 swim with a t-shirt and shorts on.
Nice. Right.
But, and then he's like, all right, now we got to get out of the water. I'm like, damn it.
Yeah, let me go back. Like,
I'm a
you
swimmer.
You can drown me all day long.
I want to be a swimmer. Why do I need to do pull-ups?
I want to be an air crew.
Drown me all day long.
Yeah, I like it. Well, Todd, what about San Diego when you got down there? What's the, you know, what's kind of the battle rhythm there?
Battle rhythm. I love your phrasing.
I don't know. I just come up with various. I try not to use the same word twice.
The it was a little bit more drug trafficking stuff. Not too many rescues. I think the most.
That's why I said battle rhythm. By the way, their bill.
Yes, yep, yes.
See, I got it.
Yes, we're going to battle. Got it.
Actually, their SAR wasn't really SAR. It was more just cruise ship medevacs was the type of medical stuff that I saw mostly down there. Turns out old people either take their medicine and then go drink on those cruise ships, or they drink and then don't take their medication on those cruise ships and they need to get out of there. So that's pretty much the only type of rescues I really saw. There wasn't too much otherwise.
Well, how do those go, Todd? We've never seen one. Like, we never heard anybody tell a first-person story from a cruise ship medevac. In your experience, how does that go?
You have to ask somebody that was that's done one.
Okay.
I never made it to that level.
It was just that okay. I got you.
I never made flight mechanic. It just kind of got pushed to the wayside while I was there, and that was one of my reasons for deciding to get out of the Coast Guard a little bit early. So,
I got you.
I flew a couple missions doing more border patrol kind of stuff. Actually, there was a lot of that down in San Diego because I think where our base is about 14 miles from the border. So,
yeah, and the fence only extends like 40 feet into the water, so it's pretty easy to get around it.
Right.
That was
always interesting. It's hard to build a fence in the water.
Yeah, it goes a little further out, but yeah, and then it goes inland only so far as well. Right. I've flown the border many times. You're like, as soon as you get out in the desert, it stops, and it's just like, oh, okay, interesting.
Yeah, wide open. Who knew?
Yeah.
And then, so you were flying 60s down there. What's the crew complement on those things down there? So we've got a basic air crewman, yourself. We've got pilot, co-pilot. Who else?
They can go as low as that, but typically there's a like SAR is a 4-person team instead of a basic air crew. That's the flight mechanic, and then you add the rescue swimmer.
And then, do you still stand like a alert duty status as basic air crew?
Nope, there's no reason for a BA. Like I never got any. So once I switched to 60s. I was on them for a total of 3.5 years, and I never did any SAR.
Yeah.
Which was a bummer. I thought maybe a year or two it would take to get up to flight mechanic, and just didn't pan out that way.
What's the maintenance kind of cycle like compared to a C-130? I mean, is that why? Like, I mean, that's got to be a major determining factor, is just trying to keep those things flying.
Yeah, those things are brutal for maintenance. They just because helos vibrate so much. I've heard a phrase that airplanes, you know, C-130s fly, or airplanes fly, but helicopters just beat the air into submission.
Nice.
Yeah, that's
those things. Just, I mean, you get off those, and I can remember just feeling like, yeah, I've been vibrating for a couple hours now.
Yeah,
and just beat up. So, a lot quicker maintenance, a lot heavier maintenance. Plus, they get down and hover right over the water, so you get all that sea spray and the salt water up in there, and just tears wires apart, cannon plugs. I've replaced so many of those that the actual plug itself was just turning into white powder.
Wow.
So maintenance on those was brutal.
Did you ever lose a tool?
Never.
No. Good man. I was just curious. You know, I know it's a major issue. When both boat crews switched to Almas, we're like, what's the big deal? Nothing's going to fall out of the sky. You know, it's not the same as same as you guys.
I didn't lose the tool. I know it's in the bilge. I just don't want to get it.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I've had to stick around for a couple hours helping somebody else's lost tool be found.
Yeah.
And you get to a point where you're diving into trash cans and calling people at home. And But no, I was never responsible. Thank God. You never want to be that guy.
Oh, for sure, man. I bet.
It's...
Well, Todd, what are you into these days, yeah. man? I know you just graduated nursing school. Are you going to try and go like the aeromedical route, or what's the plan going forward?
I don't know. The flight nurse thing is still up in the air. I need to find out more. I'm still in that point where just a week and a half ago, passed my boards, got my RN. And so I'm going to spend the first year as a new grad. It's kind of like an on-rate, basically, all over again, to translate it to the Coast Guard terms. Spend a year as a non-rate, and then I can work anywhere. The whole reason I did this was to get into the ER and do trauma. So I'll take any trauma hospital I can in the Phoenix area.
Mm-hmm. Well, congrats, man. But huge, oh. huge congrats on that, by the way. Yeah, that's a huge accomplishment,
that's a huge
man.
Thing.
Yeah, for sure.
Thank you. Yeah, that was quite a long road, but it was worth it. Flight nurses. It's a lot of quals to keep up on that, and I'm not sure I want to go back up in the air. Sometimes I kind of enjoy solid ground these days.
Yeah,
I know that hospitals don't run into each other or fall out of the sky. So,
sure.
I probably try and do more like an ER.
Mm-hmm. Hey, that brings up a question, man. Just you were in during a time when there were some pretty tragic aircrew accidents. How did those?
Yes, there were.
How did those affect, you know, the units that you were at? I know they weren't. I don't think any were at your particular unit, right? But what? They were. I'm sorry. Which one?
I was at Barbers Point when the 6505 went down.
Okay.
That was
a year later.
47, right?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
And then a year. And a couple months later was the 1705, and two guys on that plane the previous summer just transferred out of Barbers Point. So I knew two guys on that one. One of my friends was on the, I think the tail number was the 6028, the one in Utah that crashed, but nobody was killed, fortunately. But she got pretty beat up on that one. And then I knew one of the guys from my airman program up in the 6017, the one that crashed from Sitka. That died. And then after that, there was another crash in Mobile. I didn't know anybody on that one, fortunately, but I had some friends that were really close with some people on that. So actually, except for that very last one, I've had a personal connection, yeah, to all of them.
Wow.
It beats you up mentally. Because after that, every time you fly, at least for me, that popped into my head every single time I flew is one of those crashes or something like that.
Yeah,
it makes you a more diligent flyer, more diligent maintenance person. I think you asked earlier about who was looking out the windows and, you know, like who's responsible for looking around. I said, you know, see something, say something. Even more so than normal, you know, you're just constantly scanning. I was probably starting to call out other aircraft further away, you know, just if I'm trying to make sure no aircraft gets within 5 miles of us, maybe now I'm doing it 8 miles, 10 miles, just saying. Anything I see in the sky, I want the pilots to know about.
Right.
Yeah, man, I can imagine. What did anything in particular, like anything specific, change in Hawaii after the crash? Like policies, procedures, anything for you guys that, you know, kind of came down immediately?
No, I mean, I can remember we did basically like a week safety stand down, and they flew in crew from all over the country to stand watch for us. I think they had us do a lot of painting that week, just no maintenance, no flying. Well, they kind of did the basic investigation, the initial investigation, went through the memorials and all that kind of stuff. After that, there wasn't, that I can recall, any immediate changes because the 6505, they didn't initially know what caused it. There was a lot of speculation. They speculated that the cable went up into the rotor blades and wound it up, and that's what crashed it. But it turns out it was actually the boom. The hoist, they rocked so hard when it broke free that the hoist managed to go up into the blades, which from my understanding, the engineers behind the original helicopter didn't even think that was possible. And it snapped so hard, the boom hit the blades and then sheared off and went down the side of the plane and, damaged up the rotor head or not the rotor head, the blades. And,
right.
They tried to make it back home, and they didn't. And that's pretty much all there is to it is, they tried to make the quick rush back to base. Can't remember the distance, but yeah, didn't make it.
Heavy, man.
Yeah.
Solid, solid lessons learned. And like you said, just a reminder to stay vigilant. So, you know, doesn't happen again.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Well, hey, Todd, man, we appreciate your time today. Where can people find you? I know you're, you got a photography business. You said that your mom's got a side hustle, or at least maybe a primary hustle. Where can people find them?
Yeah, you kind of how you guys found me. My Instagram is Todd_Ebner_photography, and that's my side business there. My primary business is gonna be a nurse. I hope I never see any of you guys at that job.
Solid.
Yeah.
I'll plug my mom's store. Sure. Yeah. It's the Bernina Connection here in Phoenix. She loves Coasties when they come in through town and stop by the store to see her. I've had a bunch of friends see her. So first I'll say, hey, Mom. Hey, Dad. And yeah, the Bernina Connection. It's at 44th and Indian School. And go in and say hey.
Awesome.
Awesome. Yeah.
Todd, any parting shots for us?
I don't think so. That actually flew by. I'm surprised we hit an hour already. So this has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, man, for sure. We so much appreciate your time, dude. We appreciate your service to the country and you know what you did in the Coast Guard to save lives and bring evildoers to justice and a lieutenant governor out in Samoa. So quality work, brother. Yes. Thank you for the stories. We really enjoyed them, man. Always love hearing a new perspective and love making fun of Airedales. So thanks
for sure,
us,
Todd.
Absolutely.
Thanks for your time, Todd.
Absolutely.
We are blessed.
All right. Thanks, brother. Have a good one. Stay healthy, okay?
Will do. You too.
All right,
bye-bye.
Bye.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform and like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.